Healthy Cell is different than typical supplements because it's a gel, not pills. Healthy Cell uses microgel technology, which is clinically proven to absorb 165% better than traditional pills. That means your body actually uses the nutrients, so you can feel the difference. And instead of swallowing a handful of vitamins, one great-tasting gel pack can replace up to 18 pills. Healthy Cell formulas are created by physicians and nutritionists to support energy, focus, immune health, and overall wellness. If you're going to take vitamins, they should actually work. Healthy Cell, reach your potential.
Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being extremely serious. This episode is rated a 5. When University of Iowa student Alexander Jackson dialed 911 to report a home invasion in the early morning hours, first responders arrived to a scene that didn't make sense. Everyone inside the home had been shot and killed. Everyone except Alex. He claimed he had struggled with an intruder, suffering a gunshot wound to his foot before the attacker fled from the house without a trace. But as investigators began to examine the evidence, cracks in Alex's story quickly surfaced. Within hours, police reached a chilling conclusion. There was no intruder. They believed the real danger had never even left the house, and that Alexander Jackson had murdered his entire family. This episode is titled, From Victim to Suspect. So without further ado, let's get started. On the morning of June 15, 2021, at around 8 a.m., a 911 dispatch center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, received a disturbing call from a home in an affluent, upscale neighborhood. The caller, clearly in distress, quickly gave the address and said someone had broken in and that he had been shot. When police arrived, nothing immediately seemed out of place. They rang the doorbell, knocked, waited, no answer. Not knowing what they might be walking into, officers proceeded with extreme caution. With the help of a canine unit, they entered through a sliding back door. Once inside, body camera footage showed someone lying on the floor at the base of a stairwell. As officers began clearing the home, they heard a voice. At first, they assumed it was coming from the person near the stairs, but they quickly realized that it wasn't. The voice was coming from further down the hallway, and the person by the stairs was already dead. As they turned the corner and followed the sound, they found 20-year-old Alex Jackson sitting on the floor. He had a gunshot wound to his foot, but he was alert and talking. He was the one who had called 911. As officers continued searching the two-story home, the full scope of the scene began to unfold, and it was devastating. 3 people had been shot and killed. According to the reporting from People.com, Alex's 19-year-old sister, Sabrina Jackson, had been shot while she slept, once in the rib cage and once in the eye. His mother, 68-year-old Melissa Jackson, had been killed in her bedroom, shot in the temple and the eye. And his father, 61-year-old Jan Jackson, had been shot 5 times as he came down the stairs, including 2 shots to the back of his head. All 3 were killed with the same weapon. A .22-caliber Browning semi-automatic rifle, one that came from inside their own home. Alex, however, was the sole survivor. By his account, he had struggled with a random intruder trying to wrestle the weapon away. During that struggle, he said he was shot in the foot and that the intruder fled the scene. Now, right away, something about that story raised red flags for investigators. But in those early moments, they had to work with what they knew: a reported home invasion, a triple homicide, and a suspect who had just fled the area. As Alex was transported to the hospital, officers began canvassing the neighborhood. A canine unit searched the surrounding area, while others went door to door looking for surveillance footage, anything that might show the intruder entering or escaping. Because if Alex's story was true, a killer had just walked out of that house and disappeared into the morning. In an episode of A&E's Killer Cases, Linn County prosecutor Jordan Shear explained that responding officers were tasked with, quote, tracking the area that most likely would have been the route the intruder would have taken when he left the home, end quote. But the canine unit wasn't having any luck, like, at all. So investigators shifted their focus to surveillance footage from surrounding homes. Cedar Rapids police officer Ryan Dunbar began combing through hours of video from the time frame in question. He explained, quote, "The first place I start is the house closest to them, which was right across the street. I started at about 6 a.m. and went through the footage until approximately 8:30 when I saw patrol officers arriving on scene, just to see if there was anything showing evidence of a possible intruder. There was nothing," end quote. Meanwhile, back at the hospital, Detectives Matthew Denlinger and Sarah Lucina began interviewing Alex. Detective Denlinger said, quote, "The uniformed officer had a body camera on him, so we kept that camera rolling and followed him right into the ER so they could treat his foot. At that point, we knew he was reporting there had been an intruder in his house, that he had confronted the intruder, and that the intruder had left," end quote. And if a man was roaming free after shooting four people and killing three, they needed as much information as possible, and fast. Detective Lucina explained, quote, "We didn't have a choice not to interview him right then and there. He's the only person who can tell us what this suspect looks like, so we can go find the killer before this happens to anybody else," end quote. As detectives pressed Alex for details, he gave a vague description of the alleged intruder: a black man wearing all black with green shoes, although he couldn't say exactly what kind of shoes. He also said the man was, quote, "wearing one of those ski masks or whatever," end quote. Alex went on to tell investigators that the intruder had entered and exited through the back door on the lower level of the home. But there was a problem. There were no signs of forced entry. Nothing disturbed, nothing kicked in, nothing pried open. Detective Denlinger later said, quote, "Although we had these red flags, we were also open to the idea that maybe this really did happen," end quote. Alex also tried to explain how he was shot. He said he pushed the man and the intruder responded with, "F you." That's when Alex claimed he tried to grab the gun. The man wouldn't let go, and during the struggle, the gun went off, hitting him in the foot. But here's where things start to fall apart. Forensic testing revealed only two handprints on the murder weapon, one right hand and one left hand. And both belonged to Alex. There were no other prints on the rifle. Denlinger explained, quote, "There was no evidence that anyone else was pulling on the gun or wrestling with the gun as he was holding it," end quote. So right there in the hospital, as the evidence, or lack of it, began to come together, detectives told Alex directly that his story wasn't adding up. There was no evidence to support his claim of a random intruder. But Alex didn't budge. He told them, quote, "I went downstairs and the man was there. I fought him. I got shot. I think he left," end quote. Denlinger and Lucina stayed with Alex in the hospital for more than 4 hours. And as Detective Lucina later explained, they were walking a very fine line. She said, quote, "We don't want to confront somebody whose family has just been murdered in the event that they're not the ones who did it. However, when things don't make sense, you then have to ask these hard questions," end quote. But the more they pressed, the more Alex resisted. Finally, he told them, quote, I didn't do it, okay? I would never hurt my family. They are important to me. I love them. You may not understand that, but I love them." End quote. Eventually, Alex was taken into surgery, but once he was released from the hospital, he was taken straight to the police department for further questioning. Investigators wanted to give him one more opportunity to tell the truth, to explain what really happened. He didn't, though. Detective Lucina said, quote, "He sticks to the story. You could tell, like, the gig was up, and then we let him know that he's being charged with the murder of his mom, sister, and father. And there's no reaction, almost like he expected it," end quote. Over the next year and a half, prosecutors worked to build their case against Alexander Jackson for the triple homicide of his family. And on paper, Alex didn't look like a killer. He had a squeaky clean background, an Eagle Scout in high school, a flute player in the marching band. He had never been in trouble with the law, and he wasn't known to drink or smoke or use any kind of drugs. But as investigators dug deeper, a different picture started to emerge. They learned that Alex and his sister, Sabrina, had a rocky relationship at best, largely due to their opposing political views. In fact, while he was still in the hospital being questioned the day of the murders, detectives asked him what the worst thing his sister had ever done was. His response? Simply, vote Democrat. Another Linn County prosecutor, Monica Slaughter, later explained, quote, "They had significantly different political views. She was afraid if he found out that she was bisexual, what he would do to her. There was definitely tension in their relationship," end quote. At the time of the murders, Alex was a junior at the University of Iowa working toward a business degree. But during the COVID-19 pandemic, when classes shifted online, he began to struggle, badly. By his final semester, he had essentially failed out. Meanwhile, his father, Jan Jackson, was paying for those classes, the same ones Alex wasn't passing. Slaughter said Alex's father, quote, "told him that he was tired of him not living up to expectations, that it was time for him to stop gaming, grow up, and get a job. He was failing out of college, he was gaming, he was not doing anything," end quote. And then there was his financial situation. At the time of the murders, Alex had only $30 in his bank account. Investigators and prosecutors would later argue that this was the driving force behind it all. Because if Alex killed his family, his problems would disappear. He would become the sole survivor, and he would be able to collect whatever was left behind. Insurance money, assets, everything. The trial for Alexander Jackson began in January 2023, and going into it, the prosecution knew they would be relying heavily on circumstantial evidence, but they believed they had a strong case. Alex, however, looked like a completely different person. When he was first arrested, he was described as a chubby college kid, but now he had lost a significant amount of weight, possibly even over 100 pounds. His hair was long, pulled back into a knot, and he had grown a mustache and goatee. Prosecutor Jordan Shear said he wanted to quickly make one thing clear to the jury. Quote, "This isn't a loving family that the defense is going to come and try to show you," end quote. So they started with the neighbor across the street, Lydia Yang. According to Killer Cases, her home surveillance cameras showed nobody coming or going from the Jackson home at any point before, during, or after the crime. Then they turned to the murder weapon. The prosecution called investigator Brandon Bosenberg to the stand. He testified that the weapon, a .22 caliber Browning rifle, was so unique and difficult to load that he himself actually had to watch a YouTube tutorial just to figure it out. Prosecutor Monica Slaughter explained, quote, "It told us that the person who used the firearm knew how to use a gun that even our expert couldn't figure out initially," end quote. But the key witness for the prosecution was Detective Matthew Denlinger, the lead investigator who had interviewed Alex at the hospital. And so the jury could fully understand what happened during that interrogation, they watched all 4 hours of it. While the prosecution presented their case without much issue, the defense took a very strategic approach. They criticized Cedar Rapids police for interviewing Alex in the hospital, arguing that he was in shock and under the influence of pain medication at the time. And they had a strong advocate leading that charge. According to Killer Cases, defense attorney Tyler Johnston was widely considered one of the best public defenders in the state of Iowa. Detective Denlinger even acknowledged that, saying, quote, "The defense attorney is extremely experienced, so he knew what he was doing. But I came prepared. The fact that Alex had been on fentanyl and that we chose to interview him right there seemed to be a really big sticking point for the defense," end quote. During cross-examination, Johnston pressed Denlinger on that decision, arguing that the interview didn't have to happen in the hospital. But Denlinger didn't back down. He told the jury, quote, "If you think about it, if I don't interview him there, the one person who witnessed this happen, the one person who could provide information, and I wait 72 hours while the gunman who murdered three people is out wandering the neighborhood, and he dies in the emergency room, now we have no information. Like I said before, I'd fire myself if I did something that stupid," end quote. Then Johnston fired back. He pointed out that if Alex had truly shot himself in his bedroom in his foot, there was no bullet found there, and no shell casing either. Denlinger, however, acknowledged that, but added something important. At one point, Alex had a shell casing in his hand. So Johnston pushed further. He said, quote, "So you think that after he shot himself, he took the firearm back up the hallway and dropped it off on the other side of his father? Is that your theory?" End quote. And Denlinger responded, without hesitation, "That's exactly what I think happened." Mic drop. Anyway, on the other side, just as the prosecution had predicted, the defense focused heavily on Alex's background and character. His best friend, a guy named Ryan Burrick, testified on his behalf. They painted a picture of Alex as a good kid, someone who had never been in trouble, who worked hard, and who came from a strong, supportive family. They even called a former member of his scout troop to testify, although he hadn't been involved in Eagle Scouts for several years. The trial lasted 6 days, and both sides delivered powerful closing arguments. Honestly, they're so impactful that I don't even want to try to summarize them. Instead, I'd rather you hear them for yourself in these clips. So first, here's Monica Slaughter for the prosecution.
You think about what it's going to feel like to get shot in the foot when you've planned to try and cover up three murders that you've committed by shooting yourself in the foot, ladies and gentlemen. Thought it hurt worse. This was not some random intruder that breaks in and executes a family that he doesn't know with a gun that he didn't bring with the hope to steal things that are never stolen. Where there's a struggle with a huge man and a tall man. A black man with green shoes wearing all black and a ski mask with gloves on. Makes no sense. The murderer in this case that you're looking for, ladies and gentlemen, is seated right behind me. And that murderer is Alexander Jackson. There is only one conclusion that you as jurors are going to be able to reach, and that is that this defendant is guilty of all three counts of murder in the first degree. Thank you.
And now, here's the public defender, Tyler Johnston.
Prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Why would Alexander Jackson kill his family? It makes no sense. This was a normal family. This was a happy family. He was an Eagle Scout. An Eagle Scout. There's simply no motive for Alex to do this. And no motive has ever been proven. Home invasions happen. They happen, unfortunately, all over the country. When you look at this neighborhood, if someone was going to do a home invasion, this would be the perfect neighborhood for it. This is a picture of Alex when he gets there at the hospital. You can see in his eyes the shock and the terror. And Sarah Lacina says, is your foot real bad? Do you think you can hold off on pain meds for maybe 15 minutes for us to talk to you? Can you imagine if you were Alex's parent in that situation? Would you stand for that? Would anybody stand for that? For us to sit back and Monday morning quarterback what he said and how he said it when he's in this condition, while he's been given pain medication, to judge his responses and the way he said them and the accuracy of those things is tantamountly unfair. We believe that reasonable doubt is all over this case. Alex had no reason to want to harm his family. And we would ask that you return a verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
After closing arguments, the jury deliberated for just 6 hours before reaching a verdict. They found 22-year-old Alexander Jackson guilty on all three counts of first-degree murder. He was later sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences. And I think Monica Slaughter said it best in her interview with Killer Cases when she said, quote, "The only word I can use to describe what happened to this family is tragic. There is not a winner in this case. The Jackson family should not be dead, and that young man should not be spending the rest of his life in prison. Tragic." End quote.
This episode sponsored by We Feed Raw. Have you ever actually looked at the label on your dog's food? Most dog food labels are a long list of things that don't look like food. Powders, starches, additives used to hold ultra-processed kibble together. At We Feed Raw, the label looks very different. High-quality meat, nutrient-rich organs, complete and balanced nutrition formulated by PhD nutrition experts. No fillers, no artificial preservatives, just real ingredients that support your dog's whole body health. That's why many pet parents see real changes after switching to We Feed Raw's fresh meals. If you want to feed your dog one of the healthiest diets possible, We Feed Raw makes it simple. Right now, new customers can get 40% off their starter box plus free shipping. Visit We Feed Raw at wefeedraw.com to get started today.
I think one of the hardest things to grapple with in this case is understanding how someone can go from being an Eagle Scout, a band nerd, a squeaky clean all-American kid, to being accused and ultimately convicted of murdering the 3 people closest to him. In an attempt to make sense of that, reporter Sarah Kettler with A&E spoke to Dr. Rod Hovet, a forensic and clinical psychologist. While he wasn't involved in the case itself, he offered some general insight. He explained, quote, "If Jackson was a psychopath, you would expect to see a long trail of evidence to that end, harming animals as a child, setting fires, or breaking the law. It strikes me as incredibly unlikely that somebody with psychopathy could live a normal life while masking all of that underlying hostility and violence," end quote. In other words, this isn't someone who fits a typical profile. Dr. Hovet went on to explain that Alex actually had what are known as protective factors. He said, quote, "The fact that he was an Eagle Scout and able to form friendships, those are protective factors. There's every reason in the world to believe this is a good kid who wouldn't make a decision like this," end quote. And I think that's what makes this case so unsettling, because according to Dr. Hovet, this may be one of those rare situations where there are no clear warning signs. He also suggested that the possibility of being kicked out of his parents' home may have triggered something like fear or anger or desperation that ultimately led to the violence. But even then, he was careful to say, quote, "I don't know if that's true, but that reaction could fit within 2 things. His brain is not fully developed yet, and he's in this phase of emerging adulthood where he doesn't feel ready to be on his own. Just because somebody doesn't have risk factors doesn't mean they won't commit a crime," end quote. As y'all know by now, I don't end episodes by focusing on the people who commit these crimes. So instead, I want to shift our attention back to the 3 people who were senselessly taken in this case: Jan, Melissa, and Sabrina. At the conclusion of the trial, Jan's sister, Kay Jackson, and her daughter, Danielle Jackson Parsons, shared a statement with the media, and I want to leave you with their words here. They said, quote, "Alex wanted the world to think he was a victim of this horrendous crime, but we know that is not the case. And now everyone knows the truth of what happened that day. Alex murdered 3 members of our family, and that pain will never go away. Jan, Melissa, and Sabrina were loved. They will live on in our hearts and in the hearts of those who knew them forever," end quote. Okay, y'all, that brings us to the end of Chronicle 111. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Okay, well, that's all for today. So bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. Alexis McDonald is my research assistant, and Jillian Smith is my social media manager. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.